Welcome to The View on GU, the place to be for translating uro-oncology knowledge to action. Here are your hosts, Drs. Ali Khan Lalani and Christopher Wallace.
Hello and welcome to The View on GU. Thank you so much for joining, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ali Khan Lalani, joined by my co-host, Christopher Wallace. It is April. At this recording is Testes Cancer Awareness Month. To the young men out there, if you see something or feel something, please report it. There's lots of options available for you in this current era. And Chris, I guess we got to welcome you back. You've just been away. How's your travels been? Where you've been off to?
Yeah, thanks so much. It's good to be back. It's always one of those chaotic times of the year. We're sort of launching the spring conference season. We just got back from Paris. I know many urologists were there. We had a great Canadian contingent, and it's really the start of the science season, I suppose.
Yeah, it's funny. So much of our travel and academic medicine is built around not just personal vacations, but conference trips. And I think there's some staples that both you and I talk that we try and make, even in our different fields, medical oncology and urology. And they're exciting, they're fun, but there is some, you know, underlying rumblings about location, 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 and does it matter with where conferences are? Chris, I think it's fair to say our conversation today is going to be a bit spicier. I think it's going to be interesting about our social conscience and where we attend these academic conferences. This is also our first episode where we have a guest. So Chris, I wanted to turn it over to you to introduce our special guest today.
Absolutely. And so I think you've laid this out nicely. Obviously, coming back from Paris, you don't need to sell Paris too hard as a destination in and of itself. But I think there's a broader context we need to look at. And one of the interesting takeaways I had from the time in Paris is, you know, you're leaving a meeting, you're always asking your friends and your colleagues, when am I going to see you next? Are you going to be at the next meeting? And what we were hearing a lot of in Paris was, oh yeah, no, I'm not going to be there. I'm not coming. And so we saw great Canadian representation at the EAU, more than average, I think. And we're expecting less than average at the upcoming AUA meeting. And I think that's a really interesting example of people speaking with their feet. And so to sort of maybe help us understand this a bit better, I'm really happy that one of my good friends and a fantastic urologist, Diana McGee, is joining us. Diana and I did residency together. She went off and trained in Philly at Fox Chase, and is now back, driving oncology care on the west end of the city in Humber. So, Diana, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to your thoughts on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, I mean, I want to launch straight into this. You wrote arguably the first paper or the first little opinion piece on this kind of topic, and you know, maybe ventured out on the ledge a little bit with a couple of your friends and colleagues. And I think a lot of the community is now kind of falling in line behind you. So I want to give you a chance to sort of explain what you guys published in Journal of Urology and really what the impetus behind doing this was.
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly it's very flattering that you think it was the first, but there were other sort of groundbreakers and other specialties that sort of jumped on this topic, ahead of us, especially, you know, medicine and obstetrics and gynecology were quite sort of vocal about this from the beginning. But the impetus was that we wrote this article that was published in the Journal of Urology in the JU Forum, looking at and arguing that we should be more considerate about where we're hosting, you know, these big international meetings because of the implications of the repeal of Roe v. Wade. And so suddenly this sort of topic that no one had, you know, needed to give a thought to about where to travel for these academic meetings suddenly became quite important, especially to women, you know, when they're making decisions about where to travel. And so the impetus really was that when you look at the demographics of urology as a specialty, it's changing. We certainly recognize that it's for a long time has been very male dominated, much like all of the surgical subspecialties. And there are increasing number of women who are residents and fellows and practicing urologists. And so you know, based on the most recent census, we're seeing about 11% of the practicing urologists are now female. And unsurprisingly so, the vast majority of them are in their childbearing years because they're younger. And there's very good data that says that female surgeons of any type have greater pregnancy complications and are at risk of late-term miscarriages more so than the general population. And so when you put these factors together, we really need to consider that if you're traveling to a state for a meeting or a country that does not allow for the breadth of reproductive health care, if something were to happen, you're putting your life potentially at risk and your well-being. And so it's trying to argue that we need to be considerate of this, especially because the vast majority of female urologists are younger. And we know how important conferences are to people's sort of academic progression. And so having to balance your academic and your professional gains against the potential for catastrophic health risks is maybe not the most fair thing.
This this is a great lead-in, Diane, and thanks for bringing this up. You've touched on a lot. It reminds me of when, you know, this is for listeners and viewers, not meant to be a per se personal political commentary, but there was always comments that when athletes, for example, had opinions, it was kind of just shut up and play. But of course, academic physicians in general are part of a larger populace that has opinions and feelings. And I wonder if we zoomed out a little bit, what your take or the data shows about wider legislative changes. So how much more conscious do we need to be in academic medicine about these changes? You've talked a little bit about attending a conference, but I wonder if there's other implications about places of training, places of living, and maybe what data or what you're observing around that.
So I think that what we're seeing, you know, is that there's a greater awareness, and that's really what this paper was aiming to do, was sort of get the rest of the specialty aware that this is a problem, and hopefully sort of take some, you know, changes forward. And so I think that, you know, people are far more aware. There have been a bunch of studies, sort of survey studies, that have looked at sort of opinions of urologists in the field and how they feel about the Dobbs ruling, which, you know, reversed Roe v. Wade or turned the sort of decision about abortion rights back to the states. And so, you know, when we look at female urologists that were surveyed, you know, 80% of them disagreed with, you know, this repeal. And a lot of people, you know, I think it was 60% of physicians, you know, that were surveyed said that if they had to pick a new job, they would be looking in states that had full access to reproductive health. And, you know, residents, you know, it was a lesser percentage, but still very impressive because they're under the pressures of having to, you know, match to a competitive specialty and they don't sort of have that sort of luxury of movement. But I think the fact that we're seeing, you know, decreased applications in states that have either full-on abortion bans or gestational limits paints a picture that people are being conscientious of what sort of environment they're about to roll themselves into for a five-year residency or the rest of their life.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing we're seeing, and at least in my conversations in Paris, we're seeing is this is going a bit broader, right? It's not just about women who need to worry about their own personal reproductive health, but maybe the general principle of the fact that as a medical organization or as a specialty, we shouldn't be bringing our resources and our funds and our support into jurisdictions that don't support not just you know, our colleagues and the members of our profession, but really the patients we're trying to serve. And so there's the immediate personal health risks that I think you're alluding to, and I think that drives maybe some of those residency decisions. But then there's the sort of broader principle of you know, is this you know, is this a region that, you know, warrants the financial benefits that come from hosting major academic medical conferences?
I mean, there's some data that says, you know, this is old, it's from 2017, but, you know, with inflation and, you know, it's got to be more than that now, You know, that in the US, the conference industry contributes $184 billion to the US economy. Wow. And so, I mean, that's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of money. That's a big influx, you know, the hotels, the restaurants, the conference centers, all of that. And to Chris's point and sort of the lead in, like, you know, should we be voting with our feet and with our wallets, like, you know, expressing our displeasure, you know, or, you know, uncomfortableness with these laws, you know, in an economic way.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that you're able to put a figure on that, because I think we see that, especially during COVID, how much conferences changed. And when we came back, I think it really struck us how much this is an important job market. And so being conscientious about how we do and where we do these things is important. So let me play a little bit of a devil's advocate and see what some viewers and listeners might be saying. Well, that's not us. We're different. So what I mean by that is we're talking a lot, and obviously the world is focused a lot on rulings in places like the United States. But what about ex-US? And let's think a little bit about Canada too. You know, what do you think this means for Canadian physicians? Do you think we're kind of shielded from this kind of discussion? You know, are we seeing this relevance of being conscious more than just being inside US borders? I mean, if we kind of apply this to Canada, what would be your kind of take on that?
I think, you know, all of these organizations, you know, they're you know, named after the country or the region, you know, the AUA, the EAU, the CUA, but they're international meetings first and foremost. And I mean, especially, you know, the EAU and the AUA, like, they're huge, huge meetings, and their reach is international. And I think, especially with the AUA, it's important to recognize, you know, the implications of the laws within the states. And I think it extends beyond sort of reproductive healthcare, and it could extend to, you know, gun carry laws and LGBTQ rights. And there are states where people don't feel sort of comfortable to attend safely. So I think this debate or this sort of conversation extends beyond just reproductive healthcare rights. And I think as a Canadian, I mean, I certainly wrote this when I was a fellow in the US. And so it was sort of more at the front of my mind. But you know, we all are mobile creatures. No one is fixed in location. And so it's very, you know, for medical students or residents thinking about where they're going to apply for, you know, training afterwards, this is a big, you know, issue to consider, especially because in Canada, you know, these rights are pretty well ensconced. I mean, nothing is, you know, permanent within politics, but you feel pretty protected as a female of childbearing years with respect to your rights. But I do think it's important that we're aware of this, because, you know, within the US, you can be a bit insular. And so recognizing that you're bringing all these people in from, you know, outside of your borders to, you know, contribute to your economy, to contribute to your science, you know, I think we need to have a bit of a more worldly view.
I totally agree. I think it also highlights, though, maybe a wider question, which is to say that, you know, the legislative environment clearly influences how people make choices. And we've seen that other examples in Canada, right? We see fluxes of physicians between provinces when there's political changes and there's, you know, political environments that affect physician migration between provinces. And so, you know, this is one example of a really hot button, I would say, legislative issue that's affecting people's behavior. But there's numerous other examples of how governments choose to interact with physician populations that affect how people practice and where people practice. And I think, you know, in academic medicine, we can get in the weeds sometimes and get very stuck in our notions of, you know, academic purity almost. But the reality is that these things, I think, drive a lot of decision making, and ought to drive a lot of decision making, because there's a lot more to life than, you know, what goes on in the walls of our hallowed institutions.
The other component to think about is that, you know, the US is a huge driver of advancing medicine and advancing science. And if suddenly you take away the ability to care for women in, you know, critical situations, you're not sort of, you're restricting the ability to move the needle forward about how to better provide care. So if big states like Texas, who have huge, you know, research budgets and huge research institutions, if suddenly one of the most sort of common things on a care algorithm is stripped out from those providers, we're now losing the ability to sort of A, educate residents, fellows, medical students, but we're also losing sort of the impetus to improve care because things are restricted. You know, it sort of brings this, if we're thinking in sort of an academic perspective, you can think that it sort of restricts our ability to improve.
Yeah, I wondered, you know, as we're talking about this, I'm aware that we have three people who are similar eras, you know, Canadian educated, fellowship in the US, and staff people where we are. Would it be fair to say, or is it an oversimplification? And I want your honest take. Would it be fair to say that the so-called our generation or this current era is likely to be more vocal and perhaps, as we've all talked about, vote with our feet more, or maybe has more privilege or more ability to amplify our message than, let's say, maybe the generation before us or those who trained us? Like, do you think there is this actual needle moving with our cohort? I mean, what are you, I'm happy to give my take on what I'm seeing from trainees and fellows, but I wonder each of you, I mean, do we really feel that our generation is likely to move the needle more and be more vocal based on what we're seeing?
I think that certainly we're far more vocal. I don't think it's an oversimplification. I think that it's probably right. I think, you know, the fact, even though that we're, you know, young of a younger generation and don't have sort of the years of academic pedigree that some of our, you know, older attendings or colleagues do, I think we're less fearless, more fearless to sort of go ahead and voice what we think is wrong. I mean, I think one of the best examples of this is Ashley Winter on Twitter just, you know, very vocally said, like, she's trying to have another baby with her husband. And, you know, she previously suffered a miscarriage and she's not going to the meeting because it's too high of a risk. And I mean, that tweet, the last time I looked, got, you know, thousands of likes and hundreds of responses. And I think that type of sort of honesty and willingness to put yourself out there is sort of more emblematic of our generation.
I agree. And I think there's also a bit of a reimagining of what medicine is. And so I would say, you know, there's maybe it's for better or for worse, there's a bit of a drift from this notion that, you know, medicine or surgery is a calling and it's the like thing to which you dedicate your life, and more an acknowledgement that it's a portion of your life and other factors need to weigh in on your decision making. And so I think we are seeing people prioritize factors other than their career progression in making decisions like this. You know, I weighed the opportunities academically and networking wise that would come from being at the meeting against my discomfort with the idea of supporting where it had been scheduled. And so you have to balance those. And in the end, for me, it was a decision that wasn't that hard, but I'm not going to the AUA. And I made that pretty clear. And then I got some great offers to participate in pretty prestigious things at the AUA. And I, you know, had to reconcile the fact that I didn't want to go with the fact that I was missing out on some great opportunities. And I think, you know, that's a trade-off that all of us have to grapple with a little bit. And I think as we maybe take a slightly different perspective on what being a physician looks like and what component of our life that represents, people come to different conclusions maybe than would have been the historical norm. I'm interested in your thoughts, Ali Khan. What do you think?
Yeah,
what's the MedOnc angle?
I think it would be, you know, I think as much as we're in so-called different sandboxes, I think there's more similarities and differences amongst those of us in the, let's say, wider GU field. If we look at just this podcast with a urologist and a medical oncologist and the topics we're talking about, I think there's quite a lot of overlap by era in how people think. And I think for our viewers and listeners, this is not meant to be just an editorial, because I think, and we'll put these links certainly to Dana's paper, but, you know, BMG, Journal of Medical Ethics, you know, abortion restrictions and medical residency applications. This is data out there. The JAMA network opened from February 2024, trends in OBGYN residency applications in the year after abortion access changes. And then, you know, other articles on practice location preferences in response to state abortion restrictions for physicians and trainees. So I'm glad to see that it's actually not just editorial views, like we're putting things into data, into print, both in terms of opinions, but in terms of what we're seeing, which is why I think it's quite nice, regardless of where you sit on political spectrum or what you believe in, that we have to have these conversations that maybe folks couldn't have before. Maybe there was fears of repercussions. And so to see all of us having this conversation, Chris, I would say that I think these are very common sense conversations. And I think we also are probably able to probably talk with a little bit of kindness, given we have so many trainees from around the world who are coming from different places and contexts that maybe these conversations aren't happening so freely. So we need to make sure we kind of respect the individual boundaries we might have. We have a couple minutes here, and this has been a great talk. I know we could do this for a lot longer. Diana, any final kind of your take or thoughts on data you wanted to highlight, or any final pieces that maybe we haven't gotten to?
I think the biggest thing is that moving forward, the real sort of purpose of that article that we wrote was to call attention to this issue. And I think now there is a greater sort of awareness of the problems with hosting meetings in states, you know, that don't have access to the full sort of complement of reproductive care. But the other thing that I think is really important, and I have not yet seen, is these professional organizations openly recognize that this is an issue and outline what they're going to do moving forward. My impression of how these meetings sites are selected is it's sort of like a cabal of people high up in the, you know, organization who arbitrarily decide. And I recognize that these meeting sites are selected years in advance. And by no means was I suggesting that they uproot, you know, our most recent or upcoming meeting to the AUA that's in Texas, you know, 9 months in advance. But, you know, we proposed, you know, offering free virtual registration and, you know, pushing for greater transparency about where these meetings are held, you know, have a town hall at the meeting the year before or 2 years before and have people sort of offer their opinions about potential sites. And I have not seen any response from these organizations, which I think in my mind is sort of, you know, disappointing.
Totally agree. As you say, it's there's enough language out there, conversation out there, that it'd be nice to see people who are in leadership roles or these major organizations at least say, we hear you, or this is our take on it. And I think some of the suggestions you've made in the paper and even today on this podcast are things that should be reflected on. So this has been great. Chris, any final thoughts from you?
Well, no, I'm really just interested to hear from our listeners and our viewers on their take. I know in Paris, I was hearing from many people that they weren't going to the AUA this year. Some of that's maybe logistics. San Antonio's not the easiest place to get to. We like direct flights because, you know, that's just how we roll. But I'm interested to know, you know, what's driving people's decisions. Are you going to the AUA? If you're not going, why not? You know, the word on the street was that we're expecting a really low Canadian turnout. So I've been told that the normal turnout's in the, you know, 130 to 175 range for Canadians at the AUA, and people are expecting 50 or fewer Canadians this year. So I'm interested to hear from those who are listening. Are you going? If you're not going, is this a part of your decision making? And is it for your own personal health, or is it on principle?
Yeah, love it. I think it's going to be great. This should generate some feedback, and I think it's going to be awesome. Chris, if nothing else from you, Diana, thank you so much for joining us today. to all of you, as you've heard, this has been a different take on, you know, really what we think is data out there, but I think it's an important topic. Please rate, review, subscribe. Let us know what you thought about this. Interact with us on our socials. On behalf of my co-host, Chris Wallace, thank you again, Diana McGee, for joining us. It's been great. We look forward to the next episode of The View on GU. Have a great day.